Hello, Vashon. This is Chris Austin with Dove Speaks, and I have with me Dr. Elizabeth Archambault, the Executive Director of the Dove Project, and we're here for our weekly show. How are you, Betsy?
I am good, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Another soggy day?
Yes, indeed, another soggy day. I was hopeful. Yesterday was really, it had the little bursts of sun, which was really lovely.
You know, like five photons got through, I think, for the Seattle region.
I know. I read last week when we had a weirdly sunny day or something, that was the 10th sunny day since October 1st.
What year? Wow, is that right?
Yeah, and you know, and when you hear that, you think, well, no wonder everyone is just ready for this to be over.
Yeah,
it is hard living in gray world.
It is a, you know, it's like being bitten to death by ducks. It's just, you know, every day this little downer. You know, you just give me a little respite.
I've never been bitten by a duck.
Well, it's like a gray day.
Okay, well, if I ever get bitten by a duck, I will keep that in mind. That that being bitten by a duck is like a gray day.
Okay, I'm going to start out with a hard question.
Yeah.
You ready?
Yeah.
How do you get Betsy out of Elizabeth? I mean, shouldn't it be Elizabethsy?
So, Elizabeth actually has the most amount of nicknames than any other name in the English language.
Really?
Yes. Fun fact.
That is a fun fact.
And so there's Liz, Lizzie, Liza, Lisa, Liza? Eliza, Betty, Becky.
Becky, really?
Oh, yeah.
Not Rebecca. I mean, I thought that came from Rebecca.
Yeah, Bess.
Bess, right.
You know, Betsy. There are so many.
That's probably for how old the name is.
Well, right. Elizabeth is a very old, traditional name.
Older the name, the more variations, like genetics. You know, the older it is. All right, I'm going off on a tangent.
Well, I mean, also, it's a long name.
That's
true.
It
has a couple different components, because then you have the Eliza at the front part where you can do all the Lizzie,
Liza, Lisa.
And then at the end you have Beth, which I didn't even say, which then turns into Becky.
Yeah.
You know, whatever, Beth.
Wow. That really was a hard question.
Well, it was more of an answer than I think you were thinking was going to happen.
I thought I was going to get shut up, Chris. You got a show to do.
But anyway, as we start today, I wanted to say a huge thank you to our 114
oh my gosh,
stand-up guys in this community.
Thank you, gentlemen.
This was so awesome. And yesterday, I got three more donations of stand-up guys. And so if you forgot to do it and you still want to do it.
You want to be part of this august group? Just so our listeners know, Betsy's talking about the 100-man campaign that the Dove Project has sponsored, $100 to stand up to violence against women. And we had 114 guys. And it's in the paper who they are. It's in the Beachcomber today.
Oh, because today's Wednesday.
Yes. So go proudly see your name in the paper and go brag to your buddies.
Yes, absolutely. That is if you got your name to me by noon on Monday, because we did have to have a cutoff.
You know what? Maybe next week we should give a shout out to those that missed the paper cutoff.
I think that's a really good idea.
Yeah.
We'll do that. Because it was super fun and super successful. And I really love doing the 100-man campaign because it's also a really easy ask.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're asking for $100, yes, and we're not asking someone to buy a ticket, then to go to an event,
an auction.
You buy a couple drinks and then you bid on auction items. And so in terms of fundraisers, I feel like this one is pretty low key. We're not asking for a lot of you.
Right. And it probably is, when you talk about the auctions, which are nice things, they're fun events, things like that. But that takes a lot of energy and resources out of the organization, where this one doesn't. It's much. I mean, it takes some planning and it takes some execution, but nothing like an auction. My gosh.
Well, right. Exactly.
Hmm.
So thank you to everyone that donated. It was really, really awesome. And it just reminds me once again, what a awesome community that we live in.
And these resources will be put to good use.
Yes.
Right back in the community.
Yes, they will. Because I know I talk about this occasionally, but so we, in essence, support, it's like 24% of the island population. So last year we supported 500 individuals. And then we also touched the middle school and high school students, mm-hmm. Because we're in there every month, and that's 900, right? And so 900 plus 500 is 1,400. And then if you figure that, I mean, especially for the folks that have come to us and called us and sat with us,
mm-hmm.
that one person in their world will also be positively impacted, like an indirect beneficiary,
mm-hmm.
right? A child, a partner.
Or a worried parent.
Worried parent.
Yeah, sure.
Right. And so the number just goes up, and I love that.
Right.
I really, really love that. And I especially love it with the prevention piece as well, because if you figure the students tell one person, a parent or, you know, another off-island friend or whatever, you have this huge number,
right,
of, you know, the starting points of prevention, mm-hmm. primary prevention. And that's super cool.
You think about, I don't know, maybe the fire department, if they went on one call a day, that'd be 365 calls. And they mm-hmm. probably don't go out on one call a day. So you wonder, you know, your interaction with the public is really big when you compare it to some other public services.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not putting out fires literally, but maybe figuratively.
Well, right, right. And a lot of people do come to us for that kind of prevention piece,
mm-hmm.
which is actually what most DV agencies strive for, is to get more people coming to them when it's not an active DV situation, when you are focusing on safety planning and the logistics around that.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's dream, really, I mean, honest to God, is to get people before that.
Sure.
To come in to talk and learn about things and get that kind of support that they need to talk about what's going on before it ever becomes the
Absolutely.
DV situation.
You know, the analogy would be preventing a disease is much simpler than curing the disease.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah. An ounce of prevention.
Yes. I don't know who said that.
You?
Abraham Franklin. I don't know. Benjamin Lincoln. I don't know.
Benjamin Lincoln. Yeah. All right. Well, cool.
You've got some wonderful stuff. I'm so excited.
Well, thank you. I'm excited too. This is actually one of my favorite topics, and I feel a little bit geeky about it because I'm also not a scientist. And so, full disclosure, this whole show is our opinions.
Oh, yeah,
not
right.
Not the opinions of VOV. So
we always forget to say that.
We do, and we're saying it right now. So VOV...
You're off the hook.
You're off the hook for what Chris and I are saying or potentially saying incorrectly, but we're going to give it our best shot here. So we're going to talk about what trauma looks like in the brain.
And what kind of trauma are we talking about? Physical trauma, mental, both?
Both.
Okay.
Both. And so, let's see. I have a... Okay. So... Examples of traumatic events, like a victim of a crime,
mm-hmm.
like domestic violence, because actually domestic violence is a crime.
Mm-hmm.
So is sexual assault, being abused as a child, surviving a natural disaster, the death of a loved one, being a soldier in an armed conflict situation.
Sure. Battle stress, sure.
Right. And so these events are beyond our control, right? And they can happen to anybody, right? And also, when we experience trauma, like domestic violence or sexual assault, at the hands of someone that we love and trust, it impacts us in a much deeper way.
Well, to me, that's always been the hallmark of what makes domestic violence different. Is it starts with love.
Yes.
And it's not like a stranger assaulted you. This is someone I trusted.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the impact of these traumatic events don't go away when the event is over, right? And so that's where the trauma piece comes in. So trauma responses are normal responses to abnormal situations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I really love talking about trauma and rewiring the brain and neuroplasticity and everything, because even though trauma can impact all of us, and it also impacts us all in a really, really different way, right? There's now a lot of science to say that we can potentially rewire the brain and create new neurons that are, you know, what fires together wires together, right?
Interesting.
To then lessen the trauma. So, it really, some types of like EMDR.
What's that?
It's a type of therapy.
Okay.
And somatic therapy is also another one. And then neurofeedback. And I know that on Island we have a couple people that do neurofeedback and EMDR. And those folks are really awesome resources. Because this is really important, because a lot of people that suffer extreme childhood trauma, they go on to develop destructive behaviors as adults, right? And this isn't news,
right,
to people. And with certain therapeutic interventions, it can actually help their brain become more flexible and adaptive, and therefore helps people create a more successful life. So the way that I think about it, because so when you say what fires together, wires together.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a traumatic experience and then you have that traumatic experience kind of like again and again and again, then what that is it makes a much cleaner path.
So you're laying down a pathway between these experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So kind of like driving a car, right? As soon as you drive the car the first time, like the very first time in your whole entire life, then it's a brand new experience, and it's the first time you're doing it. And then you get across and you say, okay. But then if it happens again and again and again, imagine you're actually driving that car across a field. Mm-hmm. And so the first time you're, you know, driving over all these weeds and bushes and everything, and the fourth, fifth, sixth time, you actually already have a path.
You have a path, and it's harder to deviate than follow the path.
Yes.
Because you've got these ruts you've made into the field.
Yeah, absolutely. Because we also know that change is super hard for brains. Because change, our brains are really hardwired to want to stay with the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
And things that are change can feel like a threat. And your brain automatically goes into a reaction that is protecting your body and your mind from that threat. And so kind of, and so you want to get back to the status quo as soon as possible, because brains do not do well with those threats.
Hmm. Okay.
So do you have any thoughts about brains right now?
My own is spinning, if that helps. No, I was discussing earlier about concussions, like this, the trauma of physical trauma, and you know the CTE is a chronic traumatic encephalitis, encephalopathy, or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're talking about with boxers and football players and things like this, that this continued injury to the brain is cumulative and it's irreversible and it's really bad. Let me kind of back up and I bought this bicycle helmet, and I bought this particular bicycle helmet because it reduces concussions from bicycle accidents by 50%.
That's cool.
Yeah. And I thought, how the heck can it do that? Well, what they found out is if you have a direct blow to the head and your head does not spin, you're unlikely to have a concussion. But when your head spins, and when I mean spin left or right, not around like Exorcist kid, that's when you have a concussion. Like any boxer can tell you, if you want to knock out your opponent, you don't hit him flush in the face. You hit him so his head, you know, knocks to one side. What happens is, the analogy is a big bowl full of jelly, and you or Jell-O, and then you twist the bowl, and the Jell-O doesn't spin at the same rate, almost like a record. And what happens is those glions and neurons and all those connecting fibers break, and that produces a concussion. Where if you hit the bowl straight on, nothing really twists. It jiggles, but it doesn't twist, and those glions and the neurons don't break. They result in injury, but not a concussion. Where was I going with this? I'm in a concussed state right now.
I think you're referring to like traumatic brain injury.
Yeah, and how that was interesting to me that this A to B path that you're talking about, that's what gets broken in a concussion, in mm-hmm. a brain injury.
Yep.
And it has to be rewired.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's my thought.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And so people react to trauma in a lot of different ways. That are unique to everyone, depending on the amount of trauma, chronic trauma. You know, if it's only, I don't want to say only, but the trauma has only happened once or twice. There is a difference. And so there's three different main responses.
Okay.
So hyperarousal, which means that you're kind of always on the alert for that thing to happen again.
Hypervigilance of this thing is going to happen. Okay.
Absolutely. Gotcha. Right. And you can understand that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think everyone has had that at some, that kind of that hyperarousal
sure.
in their brain at a certain point. Intrusion or re-experiencing events. And so this is actually something that we see in DV quite a lot, of people reliving the event over and over. And sometimes not really being able to tell if the event was today or even 10 years ago.
Would this be PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder? Is that?
Yeah.
Was that what we're talking about, mm-hmm. basically? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the memories of the event are just there,
mm-hmm.
and you relive it all the time, therefore triggering the trauma over and over again, driving across that field again,
yeah,
with
so
the
you,
path.
You don't have that distance. It's not a memory. It's a actual thing happening to you now. That's what they feel?
Right.
That, okay.
Right. And then avoidance. So kind of like the numbing, the complete checked outness,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's interesting because a lot of people in DV say, well, why don't you just leave? You should just, you know, like right. this is the answer. And that's not an easy It's not an easy fix.
No, it's an easy answer, but it's not an easy fix.
Right. And kind of the same with PTSD, because you can't really tell people to get over it.
Yeah, right.
Because it's not actually something that they're really thinking about in like in their prefrontal cortex, where you're really thinking about stuff. Mm-hmm. It's not there. It's somewhere deeper in your brain that you are actually having this neurological response. And telling someone to get over it is,
well,
it's not going to happen, because it's not a thinking
yes.
part.
You know, and I tell people, you that's such a pat answer for a lot of things.
Yeah.
And I want to say, if it were easy to get over, I would have done it.
Right.
But it isn't, clearly. I don't do this for my enjoyment. I don't relive these horrific memories for my enjoyment or to be cool. I can't stop. And saying just get over it doesn't work.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And we are going to take this moment.
I'm so upset now. Get over it, man.
To thank Vashon Community Care Foundation. VOV support is provided by Vashon Community Care Foundation, financial support for Vashon Community Care, which has been providing senior living choices for island residents since 1995. They now also include rehab services. So you can give them a call if you are in need of this type of support at 206-567-4421. And we would also like to thank Mostly True Vashon Tours. This portion of VOV programming is supported by the Mostly True Vashon Tours. Based on the popular Mostly True History book series, these tours offer a lighthearted history of our island and show you where historical events actually happened. Along the way, you will experience all that Vashon has to offer in the way of local food, spirits, and recreation. For more information and tickets, visit vashontours.com.
Very good.
So, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, you were talking about the PTSD, PTSD,
mm-hmm.
and we mostly associate that with the military.
Yeah, it's true.
And I was watching a program on the fighting in the South Pacific during World War II, and this guy had done a lot of great things, and his family was talking about him. He died some years previously. He said, you know, as he got older, he got some dementia, and he forgot us, he forgot who he was, but he never forgot the Pacific.
Right.
That was that trauma that he lived through, that was the last thing to go in his brain. Of his children he'd had, you know, for 40 years himself.
Right.
It's amazing how, you know, deep that can run.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's, it impacts then every part of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Every part of your life. So, related, but not exactly the same. I actually read an article, this week, and it is called "A New Brain Study Sheds Light on Why It Can Be So Hard to Change Someone's Political Beliefs." And we are not here to talk about political beliefs, right? But I think it's interesting because people react to an inconvenient truth, i.e., like, you know, a partisan belief,
sure,
as if they were personal insults, right? And so the study was super duper cruel, and they put people in these MRI machines and fed them all sorts of different statements that both aligned and misaligned with their belief system, their political belief system, and when they were told the ones that they were not aligned with. Mm-hmm. The part of the brain that lit up was the part that really has to do with self-identity.
Really?
And so, but then when they were told things like, oh, who said an ounce of prevention is a pound of cure? Was it George Washington? And then, so if you say the wrong person, and since we actually don't remember who the person was, it's easy to say. But it's so much easier for our brains to connect outside facts that really have no bearing on us. Like, was it George Washington? And you say, yes, it was George Washington. And your brain kind of like, oh, you know, clicks around. It's like, okay.
Yeah. Like, who cares? But yeah, all right, fine.
Right.
It's a fact. Big deal.
Right. But then if you say something that's really very partisan.
Right. I believe this.
Right. Then all of a sudden it lights up and your brain feels it like a personal insult. And that means that, I mean, it's an attack on yourself. And the brain is built to protect itself.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So from the change in belief. And this is also, you know, changed in all sorts of different ways. Why people have a really hard time leaving people, even if it's very dangerous. Also, there are a million other reasons, sure, not just what's going on in your brain.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting because it also says... the brain processes politically charged information or information about strongly held beliefs differently and perhaps with more emotion than it processes more mundane facts. This can help explain why attempts to correct information can backfire completely, leaving people more convinced of their convictions. Doesn't that make sense?
Oh my gosh. You know, and it just, you think of some of the most outlandish falsehoods people believe, and they why does it go away? You know, the facts are so plain to everyone else, but these some people,
well, right,
their brain is protecting them.
Like if you seriously with 100% of your body believed that the earth was flat,
mm-hmm,
and I come and I say, No, the earth is round. Then your brain lights up and it's a personal insult, and then it protects itself and it makes itself more and more certain that, right, you are right.
I'm doubling down on my belief.
Yes.
And that, you know, the billions of people who think otherwise are all wrong.
Right. Exactly. Wow. Because that's your brain protecting itself.
I think
it really can help explain a lot of different things that people go through, even on a daily basis with change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's a new house, you know, even though you're excited about this, still your brain has to make the leap from what the status quo is to a new status quo.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder how someone like, you can think of people that, well, you know, when you're a teenager, you're whatever, you're pretty liberal. You know, you want to save the world and unicorns and all that stuff. And then when you get to middle age, you're not. You know, some people aren't. Some people change, some people don't. But how does that, what's the brain doing there that your kind of ideology changes over decades? I don't know. I'm just making stuff up.
Yeah, well, I have no idea. But, but this also does help explain for me a little bit about, you know, there are a lot of people in the world that do have denial about,
absolutely,
about domestic violence.
Well, you know, that's such a good point, Betsy, because somebody could say, you know, isn't your spouse doing this and it's wrong and you feel that's a personal insult and you're doing every mental gymnastic to make that argument that it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why this is hard to uncover, to bring to light. Is that kind of the same action be unfolding here?
Yeah, I think so too. And I also think that it probably happens with people that really say, I'm sorry, domestic violence doesn't happen here. Right? Because
right,
then
right,
if you are then going to change your mind to it does happen here, then that's actually a neurological response. It's not an easy thing, because where you're kind of like your habits and everything live in your brain is in your limbic system. And that's like the habit, you brush your teeth, you don't really
right,
think
and,
about
and,
it.
And that's an old part of the brain, like
right,
reptilian brain kind
right,
of
right. Yeah. And then when you have something new that you really have to focus on, like accepting that domestic violence exists, or really anything else, then your prefrontal cortex then has to be engaged. And it doesn't have, your prefrontal cortex doesn't have that, that reserves of energy. And so it's really, it's uncomfortable. And it is exhausting to, because you have to put so much thought for so long into that prefrontal cortex until it becomes more like a habit and then zips on back to your limbic system.
Wow.
And so that's, I mean, it is actually very uncomfortable for people to change beliefs. And then that's why you stay with the status quo, because it's easier.
Well, I can think this, I don't know if this is a silly analogy or not, but like when you break up with a girlfriend or boyfriend, and you know, you've got that brain protecting you, like, oh no, it's fine, you know. And then the day comes, like, it's over. It's and over. You physically feel ill. I mean, there's no pathogen in your body, but you feel ill. And that's kind of the harbinger of maybe you're changing your mind. I don't know. But it always amazes me how the body can feel this, just like you got punched in the stomach.
Yes.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And I like it.
No. Absolutely.
She should come back to me. I'm just kidding. She shouldn't.
Regardless of the right or wrong answer.
That's right. There are no wrong answers on this show.
There are no wrong answers. Well, I think we've actually chit-chatted our way through our time here. So,
My brain doesn't recognize that. I'm sorry.
Yes. So thank you, everyone, for listening. And if you have any questions or want to correct any of the things that we have said, we are, in fact, not neurologists.
No.
But I do find this, I mean, neurology just fascinating. So.
It really is. I mean, kind of one of those subjects that you almost don't want to admit that it's has as much power as it does. To think that, you know, my decisions are governed by things that might be a little bit out of my control. It's kind of scary, you know. Or to think I can't change my mind when the facts are presented to me because of this protective method, you know, thing.
Right. I mean, I can take it to. I'm trying to not eat sugar. And
well, that's just wrong.
My limbic system, eating sugar is a habit.
Yep.
And I do it without even thinking of it. I eat cake without even thinking of it. I eat cookies without even thinking about it. And so now I'm trying to not do that. And it is really hard.
Yes.
Right?
It
and,
is.
And you can change that habit. Mm-hmm. But every single time I go into the kitchen, usually at night, I'm making my prefrontal cortex work.
Yep.
Because I'm out there and it is uncomfortable, and I want to zip back into my limbic system of being like, it's actually easier if I eat a cookie right now.
Yeah. And you think about it, you think about overweight in general, in this society, you have triggers everywhere you look, TV, radio, billboards, you go down the street, you see wonderful restaurants. I mean, it's not like that with other addictions and other problems. Like I don't walk down the street and see promotions for gambling or things like that that are also addictive. But food, you know, and you have to do it. You don't have to gamble to survive. You have to eat.
Right.
I'm going on a tangent.
Right. But okay. You don't have to eat the whole cake.
Right. Now there.
Maybe.
Now you're talking crazy.
Anyway, sorry for the tangent, everyone. But thank you so much for listening. I am Betsy Archambeau, and you are?
Chris Austin.
And this was Dove Speaks, and we will catch you next week.
All right. Have a good week.